The first line usually presented at this time by the makers of Wrigley's Spearmint Gum over most of these stations will not be heard tonight due to a special political broadcast which follows immediately. At this time, under the sponsorship of the Democratic National Committee, we present a political broadcast by Franklin D. Roosevelt, Democratic candidate for re-election as President of the United States, who will be presented to the radio audience by Robert E. Hannigan, Chairman of the Democratic National Committee. Mr. Hannigan.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
My fellow Americans, I'm speaking to you tonight from the White House. I'm speaking particularly on behalf of those Americans who, regardless of party, I hope you'll remember that, very much hope that there will be recorded a large registration and a large vote this fall. I know, and many of you do from personal experience, how effective precinct workers of all parties throughout the nation can be in assuring a large vote. We are holding a national election despite all the prophecies of some politicians and a few newspapers who have stated time and again in the past that it was my horrid and sinister purpose to abolish all elections and deprive the American people of the right to vote. These same people, caring more for human riches than human rights, try to build up bogeys of dictatorship in this republic. Although they know that free elections will always protect our nation against any such possibility. Nobody will ever deprive the American people of the right to vote, except the American people themselves. And the only way they could do that is by not voting at all. The continuing health and vigor of our democratic system depends upon the public spirit and devotion of its citizens, which find expression in the ballot box. Every man and every woman in this nation, regardless of party, who have the right to register and to vote, and the opportunity to register and to vote, have also the sacred obligation to register and to vote. For the free and secret ballot is the real keystone of our American constitutional system. The American government has survived and prospered for more than a century and a half, and it is now at the highest peak of its vitality. This is primarily because when the American people want a change of government, even when they merely want new faces, they can raise the old electioneering battle cry of throw the rascals out. It is true that there are many undemocratic defects in voting laws in the various states. Almost 48 different kinds of defects. And some of these produce injustices which prevent a full and free expression of a public opinion. The right to vote must be open to our citizens irrespective of race and color or creed, without tax or artificial restriction of any kind. And the sooner we get to that basis of political equality, the better it'll be for the country as a whole. Candidates in every part of the United States are now engaged in running for office. All of us who are doing it are actuated by a normal desire to win. But speaking personally, I should be very sorry to be elected President of the United States on a small turnout of voters. And by the same token, if I were to be defeated, I should be much happier to be defeated in a large outpouring of voters. Then there could not be any question of doubt in anybody's mind as to which way the masses of the American people wanted this election to go. The full and free exercise of our sacred right and duty to vote is more important in the long run than than the personal hopes or ambitions of any candidate for any office in the land. The administration, which must cope with the difficult problems of winning the war and of peace and reconstruction, should be chosen by a clear majority of all the people and not a part of the people. In the election of 1920, one of the most fateful elections in our history, as it proved, only 49% of the potential voters actually voted. Thus, more than one half of American voters failed to do their basic duty as citizens. We can be gratified that in recent years, the percentage of potential voters in national elections who actually voted has been steadily going up, but it's a slow process. In 1940, it was 62.5%, and that still is not nearly good enough. This year, for many millions of our young men in the armed forces and the merchant marine and similar services, it'll be difficult in many cases and impossible in some cases to register and vote. I think the people will be able to fix the responsibility for this state of affairs, for they know that during this past year, there were politicians and others who quite openly worked to restrict the use of the ballot in this election, hoping selfishly for a small vote. It is therefore all the more important that we here at home must not be slackers on registration day or on election day. I want to make a special appeal to the women of the nation to exercise their right to vote. Women have taken an active part in this war in many ways. In uniform, in plants and shipyards, in offices and stores and hospitals, on farms and on railroads and buses. They have become more than ever a very integral part of our national effort. I know how difficult it is, especially for the many millions of women now employed, to get away to register and vote. Many of them have to manage their households as well as their jobs, and a grateful nation remembers that. But all women, whether employed directly in war jobs or not, women of all parties and those not enrolled in any party, this year have a double obligation to express by their votes what I know to be their keen interest in the affairs of government, their obligation to themselves as citizens, and their obligation to their fighting husbands and sons and brothers and sweethearts. It may sound to you repetitious on my part, but it is my plain duty to reiterate to you that this war for the preservation of our civilization is not won yet. In the war, our forces and those of our allies are steadily, relentlessly carrying the attack to the enemy. The Allied armies under General Eisenhower have waged during the past 4 months one of the most brilliant campaigns in military history, a campaign that has carried us from the beaches of Normandy and southern France into the frontiers of Germany itself. In the Pacific, our naval task forces and our army forces have advanced to attack the Japanese more than 5,000 miles west of Pearl Harbor. But German and Japanese resistance remains as determined and as fanatical as ever. The guns of Hitler's Gestapo are silencing those German officers who have sense enough to know that every day that the fighting continues means that much more ruin and destruction for their beaten country. We shall have to fight our way across the Rhine. We may have to fight every inch of the way to Berlin. that we Americans and our British and Russian and French and Polish allies, in fact, all the massed forces of the United Nations, we will not stop short of our final goal. Nor will all of our goals have been achieved when the shooting stops. We must be able to present to our returning heroes an America that is stronger and more prosperous and more deeply devoted to the ways of democracy than ever before. The land of opportunity. That's what our forefathers called this country. By God's grace, it must always be the land of opportunity for the individual citizen, ever broader opportunity. We have fought our way out of economic crisis. We are fighting our way through the bitterest of all wars. And our fighting men and women are plain, everyday citizens, have a right to enjoy the fruits of victory. Of course, all of us who have sons on active service overseas want to have our boys come home. Come home at the earliest possible moment, consistent with our national safety. And they will come home and be returned to civilian life at the earliest possible moment, consistent with our national safety. The record is clear on this matter and dates back month on month. Bills to provide a national program for demobilization and post-war adjustment, and I take an example, were introduced by Senator George and Senator Murray last February, nearly a year ago. This legislation, since May 20th, 1944, has contained the following provision, and I quote, "The War and Navy Department shall not retain persons in the armed forces for the purpose of preventing unemployment or awaiting opportunities for employment." And that provision was approved by the War Department and by this administration months ago. On June 12th, the Director of War Mobilization, Justice Burns, made a public statement in behalf of this bill. He said, "Our fighting men are entitled to first consideration in any plan of demobilization. Their orderly release at the earliest possible moment, consistent with the effective prosecution of the war, has ever been the primary consideration of both the President and the Joint Chiefs of Staff." And on September 6th, the War Department issued its plan for speedy demobilization based on the wishes of the soldiers themselves. Well, the George bill has been passed by the Congress. It has been signed by me. It is now the law. That law is there for all Americans to read, and you do not need a legal training to understand it. It seems a pity, a deep pity, that reckless words based on unauthoritative sources should be used by anyone to mislead and to weaken the morale of our men on the fighting fronts and the members of their families here at home. When our enemies are finally defeated, we all want to see an end at the earliest practicable moment to wartime restrictions, the wartime controls. Strict provisions for the ending of these inconveniences have been written into our wartime laws. Seems to me that it's largely a question of knowing the truth. Those who fear that wartime measures like price, rent control, and rationing, for example, might be continued indefinitely into peacetime ought, in common decency, to examine these laws. They will find that they're all temporary, to expire either at an early fixed date or at the end of the war or 6 months after the war or even sooner if Congress or the President so determines. The American people do not need, and no national administration would dare to ask them, to tolerate for a minute any indefinite continuance in peacetime of the controls essential in wartime. The power of the will of the American people, expressed through the free ballot that I've been talking about, is the surest protection against the weakening of our democracy by regimentation or by any alien doctrine. And likewise, is a source of regret to all decent Americans that some political propagandists are now dragging red herrings across the trail of this national election. For example, labor baiters, bigots, and some politicians use the term communism loosely and apply it to every progressive social measure and to the views of every foreign-born citizen with whom they disagree. They forget that we in the United States are all descended from immigrants, all except the Indians. And there is no better proof of that fact than the heroic names on our casualty lists. I have just been looking at a statement by a member of the Congress, Representative Anderson, chairman of the House Committee on Campaign Expenditures, about a document recently sent free through the mails by one senator and 12 representatives. All of them Republicans. They evidently thought highly of this document, for they had more than 3 million copies printed free by the government printing office, requiring more than 18 tons of scarce paper, and sent them through the mails all over the country at the taxpayers' expense. Now let us look at this document to see what made it so important to 13 Republican leaders at this stage of the war, when many millions of our men are fighting for freedom. Well, this document says that the red specter of communism, I'm quoting, is stalking our country from east to west, from north to south. The charge being that the Roosevelt administration is part of a gigantic plot to sell our democracy out to the communists. This form of fear propaganda is not new among rabble-rousers and fomenters of class hatred who seek to destroy democracy itself. It was used by Mussolini's black shirts and by Hitler's brown shirts. It's been used before in this country by the silver shirts and others on the lunatic fringe. But the sound and democratic instincts of the American people rebel against its use, particularly by their own congressmen and at the taxpayers' expense. I have never sought, and I do not welcome the support of any person or group committed to communism or fascism or any other foreign ideology which would undermine the American system of government or the American system of free competitive enterprise and private property. That does not in the least interfere with the firm and friendly relationship which this nation has in this war and will, I hope, continue to have with the people of the Soviet Union. The kind of economy that suits the Russian people, I take it is their own affair. The American people are glad and proud to be allied with the gallant people of Russia, not only in winning this war, but in laying the foundations for the world peace which I hope will follow this war. And in keeping that peace. We have seen our civilization in deadly peril. Successfully, we have met the challenge, due to the steadfastness of our allies, to the aid that we are able to give to our allies, and to the unprecedented outpouring of American manpower, American productivity, and American ingenuity, and to the magnificent courage and enterprise of our fighting men and our military leadership. What is now being won in battle must not be lost by lack of vision or lack of knowledge or lack of faith or by division among ourselves and our allies. We must, and I hope we will, continue to be united with our allies in a powerful world organization which is ready and able to keep the peace, if necessary, by force, to provide that assurance of international security is the policy, the effort, and the obligation of this administration. We owe it to our posterity. We owe it to our heritage of freedom. We owe it to our God to devote the rest of our lives and all of our capabilities to the building of a solid, durable structure of world peace.
You have just heard an address by the President of the United States. And now you will hear Robert E. Hannigan, Chairman of the Democratic National Committee. Mr. Hannigan.
Just a brief message to you Democratic Party workers gathered in thousands of American homes tonight. Our immediate task is to make certain that every qualified voter is registered and gets to the polls on election day and votes. Take nothing for granted. Victory is ours, but we must work for it. You know the task ahead in your own community. We are counting on you, the soldiers in the ranks of the Democratic Party, to make certain that our democracy functions with a full vote in November. Thank you and good night.
Ladies and gentlemen, you will now hear from California's junior senator, Sheridan Downey, who has returned to California to conduct hearings in the matter of reconversion of California's industries from a war to a peacetime basis. It is now my pleasure to introduce to you Senator Downey.
Ladies and gentlemen, again we have had the privilege of listening to one of President Roosevelt's inspiring talks. Again we renew our determination that he shall be reelected. Again we are inspired to rededicate ourselves to the great tasks that lie before us. The winning of the war for freedom and the reconstruction of the world into a better place for all peoples to live. Now the people of California must begin to look forward to the critical post-war period, which will require all of our genius for reconstruction to avoid the blows of dislocation to peacetime production. In the past few weeks, I have been in many conferences with the officials of our military agencies, the Army and Navy departments, and with the heads of the War Production Board, the War Manpower Commission, and the smaller War Plants Corporation, both in Washington and in California, over the many problems of reconversion and of employment for the post-war period and for the interval of transition from war to civilian production. With the assistance of all the federal departments and the military agencies, we shall begin next week most important hearings in California to find the basis of recommendations not only to our Army and Navy and our civilian departments, but likewise to the Congress of the United States on the many vital problems of the future of industry in the state of California and the employment of her people. If there is a shift of the burden of war production to the Pacific coast, when the war in Europe shall have ended, and while we are still engaged in hostilities with Japan in the Western theater of the Pacific, we must see that Eastern manufacturers do not gain any advantage over Western manufacturers in the reconversion of their industries. For that might well mean the eventual extinction of California industries, which we have builded with the toil and sweat of our workers and the technique of our business leaders and engineers, because their markets will have been absorbed and consolidated before we have had the opportunity to reconvert. We must have jobs for all of our people, not only for the duration of the war with Japan, but after it has been brought to a victorious close. And to supply these jobs in California, we must have peace industry to open wide the doors of employment. Hundreds of thousands of new citizens have come into California from every other state in the Union to lend their aid to our war industries. According to the latest survey, 75% of them will elect to remain as citizens of this state. And we must find the employment that will suit their needs. And all that we ask to do it is equality in post-war planning. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, after listening to President Roosevelt tonight, our thoughts and our prayers are not only for the nation and the world, but for our state of California of today and tomorrow. May God speed the peace that will bring our sons and daughters back from the fields of war to a nation of employment and prosperity, and to a world of order and international justice, where war shall forever be prevented by the implemented force of a League of Nations. Such was the mighty vision of Woodrow Wilson 25 years ago. Such today and tonight is the determination of Franklin Roosevelt. Let us, by our support of that vision and of him, our president, help to bring such a nation and such a world to reality. Today, mankind possesses and is possessed by mighty forces. We must master these forces or they will master us. Civilization can never survive another worldwide war unless in America there is the courage, the leadership, the vision for a wise and just internationalism. Greater and greater catastrophes will be the fate of all nations and all peoples. That leadership and that vision and that courage can best be found in Franklin Roosevelt in the White House.
Thank you, Senator Downey. Ladies and gentlemen, you have just heard from California's junior senator, Sheridan Downey, who has returned to California to conduct hearings in the matter of reconversion of California's industries from a war to a peacetime basis. We now return you to CBS in New York.